Hello and welcome to The Academinist, the podcast about equality and feminism in STEM.
We're your hosts, Jodie
and Rebecca, two neuroscientists in London
who just happen to be women.
Join us as we discuss how inequality affects women and minorities in science today and what we can all do to fix this. Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Academinist, the podcast about equality and feminism in STEM. I'm Rebecca.
And I'm Jodie. We're recording this on the Mondayest Monday of Mondays. Just so that everyone can have an accurate picture of me right now. I'm led on the bed, I've got microphone in hand, laptop on my stomach, and I'm just... we're going to slowly pull the covers over me and, you know, by the end of the episode, it might just be Rebecca.
Yeah, yeah. If Jodie's gone quiet, or, you know, if you hear a little bit of a snoring. But, yeah, we're not about all this like professional gatekeeping in podcasting. We believe in being comfy and just doing what you want.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is why I'm not in television, right?
Yeah. Yeah, just like going live to our correspondent Jodie, and she's just a pair of eyes over the top of a duvet.
Podcasting is definitely my forum.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah, we're back for another month. It's flown by as usual. I mean, it wouldn't be another episode of The Academinist if Jodie and I aren't constantly amazed at the passing of time.
I don't know how it continues to surprise me.
Yeah.
But yeah. No, I can't believe we're halfway through the year. How mad is that?
I know, tell me about it. And if anything, I feel like nothing speeds up time more than starting to write your thesis. So yeah, that's a thing that I'm doing now.
I mean, when are you planning to submit it? Like, how many months in are you, and how many months?
You're making me go on record on a publicly distributed podcast.
I am, yeah. She says that she's
talk about accountability.
your accountability buddy.
Yeah. No, so the plan is to submit my thesis by the 30th of September.
You heard it here, everyone.
That's gonna be played back to me as a sad little soundbite. I know, yeah. It.
On the day that we released the September episode.
Yeah. Or like, yeah, 6 months from now. Just like, what was it you said, Rebecca? Oh, well, you heard it here first, everyone.
Oh, no, but that's exciting, though.
Yeah, it is. I feel like I haven't got to the stage where I'm just like, I hate it. I just want it done. I'm like, oh, this is actually quite nice. It's different. And like, I think my brain's just enjoying doing something different to constantly slogging through lab experiments. Mm. But yeah, ask me again. Come back next month and find out.
Yeah, let's see if you're still, you know, enjoying the process.
Yeah. But yeah, how's everything with you? Science life, non-science life, all fine?
Well, yeah, it's fine. Yeah. You know, now I'm basically doing a lot of new stuff, like new techniques, new experiments. So it's like a lot of learning at the moment, which is tiring but exciting. And yeah, preparation for going to San Diego. So I'm going to the Alzheimer's Association conference in like 4 weeks. So things are a bit crazy. But exciting, yeah. And good, you know, all the same. So I think it's going to be a busy summer, but then I feel like as an academic, you say this all the time, but yeah, hopefully things will slow down again soon, or like hopefully next yeah, month won't be as crazy or yeah, whatever, but it will be, because I don't know how to say no, so.
But we're working on it.
We are. It's a work in progress, Rebecca.
No, for sure, because I'm definitely at the moment, I'm being like, the most ruthless I've ever been at saying no to stuff, because I'm like, you're not going to do a whole thesis if you're literally doing all this other stuff. I'm just being like, no, I've like just sort of disappeared, you know, like the you know, like gif of Homer Simpson just like melting into a hedge. That's been like me recently. Yeah, I highly recommend it. Saying no to stuff. So yeah, this month's episode is kind of a little bit different because we sort of recognize that the solutions to the problem aren't necessarily on us as just like individual PhD students. And it's a bit more about chatting about the realities, some of the hard stuff of being a PhD researcher. So this month we're talking to Sophie Langdon, who was an absolutely lovely guest to have on. She's a Cancer Research UK PhD researcher at King's College London. And we were chatting about the cost of PhDing.
Yeah, so we on purpose used this cost as in quite a vague way because, I mean, the most obvious one is the financial cost, right? So you do get some sort of wage if you're on like a funded PhD, you get a stipend, but it is nowhere near what, you know, you basically should be on for the hours that you do. And actually, when you break it down per hour, it means that you're on less. I mean, for us, we're on less than London living wage. And in some other programs, you're on less than minimum wage, which absolutely baffles me. I have 2 degrees under my belt and I'm working on my third. And beyond the kind of like feeling like I deserve more money, it's more like you physically can't survive.
Yeah.
On some of the stipends, especially in expensive places like London. So yeah, we mostly talk about the financial the costs of PhD in, but also there are other costs. So if you're having to compromise on other things in life because you're having to work part-time alongside your PhD in order to make ends meet, then that can also then affect your PhD performance. And so it's all about trying to get that balance right. And basically comparing what life as a researcher is like in academia versus outside of academia.
Yeah, and that's one thing that was actually super interesting about talking to Sophie is that she's got quite a lot of industry experience, I would say, for an average academic PhD researcher. So she was kind of dishing the dirt on both sides, which was really, really interesting. So if that's something that you're keen to know more about at all, this is the episode for you. But yeah, it was really just sort of nice to chat about some of the stresses. And we talk about this a lot as well in the episode about how when it comes to like finances and struggling financially, we quite often, it's sometimes a bit of a taboo subject and people kind of downplay or like hide that they're struggling from their peers because it's not really something that, at least for sure in here in the UK, we just don't talk about this kind of stuff.
I think also it's for mental health and well-being. Universities now try and push the you talk to someone and that you reach out for your mental health and things like that. But then when it comes to the kind of like worry and everything that comes with the financial pressure, it's kind of like, how do those things go hand in hand? If you you want students to take ownership of their well-being, but not talk about some of the key things that are causing that stress and those mental health problems, which is actually that they're overworked and underpaid.
So we won't go on and tell you everything that's in the episode, but if any of that sounds like something you're interested in, you're going to really enjoy our chat with Sophie Langdon.
Don't take our word for it, have a listen for yourself.
Hi everyone, just before we skip onto the interview, obviously this episode was recorded earlier this month and a lot of things have happened in literally the past week just before releasing this episode. So we just wanted to jump back in to acknowledge that we know a lot of people listening are having a pretty rough time right now absorbing some of the really devastating news that's happened recently in the US. Obviously, we don't have the scope to even begin to unpack this, and it would be kind of at odds to try and shoehorn in a whole complex discussion in with this subject that we're talking about in this episode. But we just wanted to jump in to say that we stand in support with all of the people in the US who are affected by this. Yeah, and just that we hope you're all okay.
Yeah, obviously I want to just add as well that to look after yourself as much as you can. So this will affect obviously people in the US and mostly minorities as well. But the appearance of this topic in social media is going to affect, you know, further than the US as well. So the Academist sends their love and support.
We have the fabulous Sophie Langdon here to chat to us. Sophie, welcome. Hello.
Hello, thank you.
So you are here chatting to us about just some of the difficulties PhD students are facing at the moment with the cost of living crisis, as well as the exodus into industry. We might hear a little bit about that. But, so all of the good stuff, really. But before we get into that, it wouldn't be an episode of The Academinist without starting off with your unapologetic introduction. So this is part of the show where we ask our guests to introduce themselves without leaving out any of the good stuff. So as women in STEM, we're often really tempted to downplay our achievements, any awards, or it doesn't even have to be a formal achievement, just stuff that we're really proud of. We're conditioned to kind of downplay that stuff. We don't do that here on The Academinist. We like to shout about it. So yeah, without further ado, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, this actually ironically was the bit that I was most nervous about, because as you say, I'm quite used to downplaying achievements. Hi, I'm Sophie. I am a second year Cancer Research UK funded RadNet PhD student, which is always a bit of a mouthful to say. I am currently researching how we can best combine radiotherapy and immunotherapy to treat head and neck cancers. It's going good, I think, I hope. But yeah, prior to PhD, I did my undergrad at the University of Birmingham. So that was an integrated master's with a year, placement year, which I did at AstraZeneca. And that actually kind of got me hooked on the whole research side of things. I'd never really considered being a researcher before that. And a PhD, I didn't really know what that involved. So it's a bit mad, really, to think that I am where I am now, because it was never something that I ever considered growing up. I think like most girls, I wanted to be a vet or like a ballet dancer at some point. So,
me too. I was team vet. Yes.
Yeah. it's kind of mad really just that I am where I am now, I suppose. After graduating, I did do some time in industry. So I was on the dark side, depending on which side you're on. Maybe I was on the good side. And have now transitioned over to academia for a spell. So yeah, I suppose that's me. I don't know. I don't really have any awards that I can think of. I did get a certificate for doing I'm a Scientist the other day. That was fun. It's this online public engagement. It's called I'm a Scientist, Get Me Out of Here. It does slightly reach a point where you want to get out of there because it's just chaos, but it's also great. It's like I had one session and there were 3 scientists and like 100 students all asking questions. And it's like almost like a Facebook chat and all these questions just fire at you and you're frantically there trying to answer them. And like, I've never typed so fast in my life, but it's really good to do. And it's really nice. I do a lot of kind of public engagement stuff outside of my PhD and I really enjoy it. And yeah, this particular bit was kind of focused with school children, and they basically just have a lesson where they get to bombard scientists with questions. So you can sign up for these live sessions or they can ask you questions directly, you know, as and when, and you can answer them as and when, and you get votes as well. So like if they really like you or if you answer their questions well, then they vote for you. And at the end, there's a prize.
Yeah, that's really cool. And that actually leads me on to what I was going to ask next. So you gave a really nice sort of introduction that summarized all of the things that you do, but what would you say that you enjoy most? Is public engagement one of those things?
Yeah, definitely. I think the whole pandemic has made me realize how important it is to communicate science and that people have a good scientific understanding from a young age. I even had friends from school who were in biology class, you know, sat next to me asking me questions that I was like, we did cover this at GCSE, you know. And like, obviously, if you don't use science in your day-to-day life, you forget it, you're not going to remember these things. But you know, when I then explained, they were like, oh yeah, I remember. So making sure that people have the opportunity to have that interaction with science from a young age, you know, it really helps, I think, encourage that and discourage the spread of misinformation. You know, there's a lot of scaremongering about science and about research, not only about the outputs of it, but like the whole process of it, how it's all done. And I think it's really important for us as scientists to be very transparent about our research and also to make sure people are involved. You know, like in academia especially, we're using taxpayer money, we're using money that people donate to charities. You know, they need to know where it's going and what's coming from it. And I think the most valuable public engagement I've done was actually something I did recently with some patients who'd undergone radiotherapy treatment. It was an initiative set up by RadNet called Radiation Reveal. And it was with young cancer patients. So like people our age who'd undergone radiotherapy. And we had several workshops talking about what their different treatments were, you know, what it was like for them, where they think the gaps in research are, you know, having experienced the therapy. And then we presented back to them, you know, like what we are doing in our research, and they had questions and everything else. And I think stuff like that, it's increasingly important to make sure that's included in our research framework, that interaction with patients to make sure the gaps are being filled and we, you know, we're not wasting money. Because I think sometimes as scientists, we can get really, really niche.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's like, actually, is this protein relevant? Is it helpful? Does it do anything? What's the bigger picture here?
I think it's really easy to end up getting focused on, like you say, like one single protein, actually forgetting the big picture is people living with the disease that we're trying to fix. And I think, yeah, it's so easy to lose sight of that.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's short answer to your question. I really like public engagement.
So just to help people get to know you a bit, this one sometimes makes people feel a bit embarrassed, but it's kind of why we love to ask it, because it's a difficult question, but it is a lovely question. We always hear some lovely things from people. Is, can you tell us something you're proud of? And this can be PhD related, science related, or anything else that you think is nice to share.
You guys really start with the hard questions, see? I suppose, like, scientifically, it would be that I graduated with a first, and I did so with a first author paper. I think that was something I never, ever thought would happen, and really showed to me like what I could achieve if I put the work in, and made me think of, you know, other options for my future, which I hadn't really, I suppose, considered to the same extent. Personally, gosh, proud of lots of things, but they're all slightly smaller.
We like to hear small wins as well. Like, it could literally be, I really didn't want to go into the lab today.
Yeah, I woke up this morning.
Right? Yeah. Nobody's come on and been like, I fixed feminism. It's not, we've sorted it out now.
No, absolutely not. I don't know if this is overly feminist or not, but I'm actually really proud that I have managed to maintain a long distance relationship. And we just moved in together last month. So
100%. It doesn't make you any less of a feminist, so yeah, that's something to be very proud of.
And I think, like, long distance as well, that needs like communication and balance on both sides, and being able to say what you want out of a relationship and things like that. So like, absolutely, that goes like, that's a good answer.
On a slightly more humorous note, I'm also learning how to roller skate. Quite proud of that, because I never learned as a child.
Amazing.
Oh my god. Oh no, that's cool. Yeah, so with all the kind of intros out of the way, we're talking today mostly about financial insecurity as a PhD student or working in academic research. But before we kind of delve into the meat of that, let's talk a little bit about your journey into STEM. So we know that every journey into science is different. So just like a brief synopsis of why you're here in STEM, why the PhD, and how you got here.
Yeah. So as I said, I did an undergrad at the University of Birmingham. So that was what I thought was a very boring topic. I just went for biological sciences because I liked biology at school. And I had friends doing all these like niche new topics, and I was like, I'm just going to stick with what I know. So I did biology. I actually started off wanting to be an ecologist. I've always been quite outdoorsy, like I thought that would suit me really well. And I started off on the 3-year bachelor's course, and then the university actually offered at the end of the first year, if you got exam results above a certain percentage, you could switch onto the integrated master's with a placement year. And I thought, seeing as employers nowadays want you to have like 10 years experience by the time you come out of uni, that maybe the placement year was a good idea. So I switched course and started looking for placement years, and basically realized there is not a lot of money in ecology. All of the placement years basically were underfunded, if at all funded. And the thought of having to move to some remote part of the country to do them, to then not be paid, was just not overly appealing. So I had also always been interested in human biology, so started looking at pharma companies instead because they do pay. I ended up getting a placement year at AstraZeneca. So like I said before, I'd never really considered research as a career. I don't know, I'd always grown up with the stereotypes of being in research, I suppose, and it seemed quite boring to be a scientist. And I hadn't really been exposed to the other side of things, which I was during my placement year, and I really caught the bug for immuno-oncology. So finishing uni, I had some friends go straight into PhDs. I found my final year of uni quite stressful because it was an integrated master's. It was almost a master's and an undergraduate final year all in one. I didn't want to have to apply for PhDs during my final year. I was like, that's one thing too many. So ended up instead doing a placement the summer after I finished uni, because at that point I was debating being in research or not. It was an internship with a startup company that was more kind of office-based, but still scientific. Realized that actually I hated sitting in front of a computer all day, and I quite liked being in the lab, and I did miss it. So yeah, basically for the next year and a half, I debated doing a PhD whilst doing other things. So I did the classic pub job, saving money for traveling, went traveling for a couple months, came back, did another internship for a different startup, this time lab-based, in Cambridge, and that turned into a full-time permanent position. So I was there for about 18 months. And after talking to a lot of people, decided to give the PhD a go. I suppose it's quite linear in that I did school, undergraduate, master's, PhD, but it's mentally not been a linear process. There's been a lot of back and forth about whether or not to do a PhD. I suppose it seems a huge undertaking, right? It's another 4 years of your life. There are, of course, as we're going to talk about, the financial implications of doing a PhD, and you hear such horror stories as well, you know, of people who've done PhDs and terrible supervisors and horrible working conditions, and you're like, oh God, why would anyone apply to do that? But, so yeah, it took time to come around to doing it.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you spent quite a lot of time actually working in industry compared to most people that go into a PhD. So could you tell us a bit about how you found industry and how perhaps any differences you've experienced between industry and academia, apart from some of the financial ones, obviously?
Yeah, I mean, so obviously I've experienced big pharma and I've experienced biotech. I found them to be quite different from each other. There is also the fact that obviously my experience of big pharma came with me as a placement student. So I suppose I was quite separate still from like the politics and the intricacies of being in a big company. So maybe I have a slightly idealized viewpoint as to what being in big pharma involves. Personally, I preferred big pharma. I thrive on structure, like I think a lot of scientists probably do. Pharma in general versus academia, it's just money, it's resources. You know, you don't agonize over whether to buy an antibody or not. You just buy it if you need it, you know, and it's it makes the research easier, I suppose, in that sense, because the resources are there. The people with the know-how are there. They have, you know, the really good core facilities and everything else, and you can just get stuff done. I find academia quite slow in comparison, and that does frustrate me.
I was going to say, that's really interesting what you say, not just about obviously the financial resources to buy what you need, but also that there's the know-how there and people to actually train you, because even with a really great supervisor, I'm sure a lot of people experience this when they're in their PhD and it turns out they need to do something and their supervisor can't directly teach them, and it's just sort of like, find someone who does it and see if they're nice enough to give you some spare time and maybe they'll teach you how to do it. And it's just like, kind of a lot rests on that, and that culture of goodwill and giving up your time to teach someone because somebody else taught you. So it's interesting that that's not necessarily the case. It's not that you have to just find anyone, that there is more of a culture that you've experienced where people are there to teach you things.
Yeah, that feeds into what we're basically talking about today as well, like in terms of free labor. because it really, like, it relies on goodwill of people, but it also relies on free labor from those people who are already working full-time on their own projects and their own things. So it also comes with a sense of guilt. I don't know if that's just me, but I find that when I'm going to someone who is not being paid to help me, and I'm kind of asking them a favor or asking them to help train me in something or to give me some of their know-how, I'm very apologetic. I'm so sorry for bothering you. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. You know, almost kind of embarrassed and feel a bit guilty for taking too much of their time when I know myself how stretched that time is. So that's another thing that's just completely normalized in academia and I assume not in industry. And that is that you are taking on job roles that are not in your job description. And not being paid or otherwise compensated for them.
I think that's also because academia doesn't have job descriptions. It's very clever in that sense.
you will do all the things.
Yeah, you know, it's everything can be in your job description in academia. So I think that is also a difference between industry and academia.
I just have one more question for you, Sophie, on this kind of industry versus academia, like the differences and things. I know in academia, and you said it yourself earlier, you described industry as the dark side, where if you believe what academia tells you, everyone does things just purely for money and not out of principle. And until very recently, we're not really told very much as PhD students in academia about other options that we might have. There's only really starting to be this kind of realization that there's not enough jobs for everyone who does a PhD to stay in academia. So we've got to be aware of other things. There's still a long way to go for universities, I think, to actually properly equip us for stuff that's not academia. But I just wondered from your perspective, from what you've experienced in industry, how is it viewed, people that perhaps in industry and then decide to switch back to academia? I don't know how rare that is, but is that viewed in a similar way to the other way around, academia to industry?
I will be honest, I find the whole divide quite ironic because I think they both rely on each other. You know, like one of the key reasons why I'm doing a PhD, obviously I love science and research, but I am doing it for the career, you know, because when I was in industry, I was in as a research associate in my last job. I was told I can work for the company for 5 years to get a promotion, or if I came in with a PhD, I'd get straight in at that level. So, you know, industry relies on academia to give people the skills like independent project management and, you know, all those other skills and soft skills and hard skills that you learn by doing a PhD. And academia relies on industry to fund academic projects, to take academic projects to the clinic. You know, it's actually quite an interlocking relationship, but both sides treat it as so separate, and the other side is always the darker side, and you always hear horror stories. You know, someone said to me the other day that they'd always been told by their supervisors, because they'd always been in academia, that all you do in industry is make media. And I was like, we had a vending machine for media. Like, you don't make media, you scan your card.
We have one of those in our building, but it's always empty.
You scan your card and the media comes out.
Which in many ways hurts more than if there just wasn't a vending machine.
They taught you.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, all these kind of horror stories get told about industry, and yeah, it's all money grabbing, it's all everything else. And I think maybe to a certain extent it was, but I really think industry is changing. You know, when I was at AstraZeneca, they'd recently moved to Cambridge from Manchester. And part of that was because obviously there's a lot of really good research going on in Cambridge. There's the university. There's also a lot of biotech and other healthcare companies in the Cambridge area. And they wanted to be more open with their research and they wanted to have collaborations and things like that. So I think pharma is moving more towards being open when previously it's been quite closed off. And potentially that's also why there's been a lot of fear mongering about industry, about business practices of pharma companies, that they're all money grabbing and everything else. My favorite theory is the one that we found the cure to cancer and pharma companies are just keeping it secret because they make more money with people getting ill. And it's like, you've got 1 in 2 people getting cancer nowadays. You know, those are the stats. If you really think that a whole company of people who probably know someone with cancer are hiding the cure to cancer, you're quite naive.
And they'd make plenty of money from a cancer drug.
You would
drug.
Make so much money.
Yep.
So, I find having now come back into academia, I spend a lot of time laughing about the divide between the two because I just think it's so unnecessary. And it's, I suppose, been quite politicized in some ways. And yeah, you know, as you say, there aren't the jobs in academia. So why are people shamed for going to industry after they finish their PhD or postdoc? You know, if you're not providing the jobs, you're not providing the money, what do you expect people to do? And I think those options really should be more talked about. You know, I've had so many people since I started my PhD come up to me going, oh, you worked in industry, like, you know, what's it like? How did you find it? And asking me all these questions because no one sat and talked to them about it. And they've gone straight from undergrad to master's to PhD. And they haven't had that experience of other things. And they don't know what to do after their PhD. And maybe academia doesn't appeal because it doesn't to everyone. You know?
I mean, I think it's because it's this divide, but it's also almost taboo. So like, I remember when I so a similar sort of thing, I kind of worked in like a startup sort of out of academia, but then coming back in, I remember for that PhD interview I was told, don't mention that you don't want to work in academia. Make sure you know, if people ask what your five-year plan is, you want to start your own lab. and it was kind of like I had to not lie to get the PhD, because obviously like that's kind of saying that I'm not didn't get it on my own merit and things like that. But I do think that me sitting there and saying, oh, I love academia and I'm going to be here for years did work in my favor. And it's, you know, that's not right, because we're closing off a percentage of people that want to do the PhD and then leave with it. So yeah, I think it's interesting that you're able to experience both sides and give us that perspective. So thank you.
Interestingly, I was told the exact same thing about interviews to say that your 5 to 10 year plan was that you wanted to be a PI. Because otherwise people wouldn't take you seriously. And I also got questioned a lot at interviews about my industry experience. And it wasn't always viewed as a good thing.
Yeah. They like the lab experience, but they're a bit suspicious of your intentions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And I got that as well. I mean, my PI said, I mean, he kind of like got me in from where I was as a research assistant. And then obviously I was applying for PhDs while I was in that role. But he said to me, if you don't like stay in the lab now, then it'll be detrimental to your career. And so I was like, okay. So I was a little bit worried that if I didn't carry on then doing lab work and academic work, then it would be a problem. So yeah, it's something that we're told, early career researchers are told. Mm-hmm. And then it's only later that then you're like, oh, there's a whole world that I could be taking advantage of and exploring. But
because I had questions like, oh, how do you think you're going to cope moving from industry to academia?
Yeah.
And I was like, what do you mean, how am I going to cope? I'm doing research. You still have pipettes, you know, like what? At the end of the day, what is the issue? Like,
yeah,
I'm still going to produce work. But yeah, it was always a really going into interviews like, oh God, are they going to bring it up? Will they be happy with it? Will they not be happy with it?
So moving on a bit to what we mainly came to talk about in this episode, which is trying to do a PhD in the current financial climate. So it's currently quite a scary, worrying, frustrating time to be doing a PhD. It's obviously there's the pandemic, and then on top of this, all of the sort of economic impact we're seeing after that. So just to kind of start things off, can you tell us a bit about how you're feeling, how this has been for you in that respect, if anything's changed for you over the past couple of years, any like differences you've noticed? How are you?
Thank you, I appreciate that. I suppose I'm feeling quite lucky in some ways, and that's probably a weird answer to the question, but the stipend that I'm on for my PhD is more than the UK minimum, because I'm Cancer Research UK funded. They tend to give better stipends. So yeah, I'm feeling really lucky, because if I was not on that stipend, I would be panicking. And the stipend was actually a big factor in deciding whether or not to do a PhD, and indeed which PhD program I then picked, because moving to London was something that I was worried about financially, and then doing it on such a small budget, I didn't want that financial stress on top of PhD stress. So yeah, I guess at the moment I am feeling lucky, and I don't want to rub that in. But I completely sympathize with the people. I mean, I think, Jodie, you're on the UK minimum, right?
Yeah, so Rebecca and I are both on the same program on the MRC DCT. Yeah. And actually, recently, the reps of that program have drafted a letter to the MRC to push for an increase, because what we're on is actually below the London living wage, which is, I mean, for want of a better word, I just find it disgusting. Because, I mean, not that I'm tooting my own horn or anything like that, but I just think you've got really educated, capable people that are not being paid their worth. And so it's like, that's one thing, that people are working often more hours than what they're supposed to for less money. And then there's the whole thing of, then you're pricing people out of a PhD. So you said that a major factor of whether you did a PhD or which PhD you applied for was actually based on whether you could afford it and based on whether the stipend was good enough. And so that means that there's a whole cohort of people out there that are not applying for PhDs and are not able to do PhDs that they're completely capable of. And then academia are missing out on all of these brains, all of these people that could be solving all of these science problems. And it just comes down to money again. And then we're back to it being the elite and you know, academia being people in the ivory tower who are then gatekeeping to opportunities.
I think sometimes you're made to feel bad about talking about money in academia, because it's meant to be like a privilege to be there, right? And the whole culture of academia is sacrifice. You know, you sacrifice your time, you sacrifice your mental health, you sacrifice work-life balance, you sacrifice financially to be there, but it's all right because you're privileged to be there and it's a prestigious position to be in. And that's, in theory, worth the sacrifices that you're making. But actually, you know, as you say, when it's not even the London living wage that you're earning, it becomes then, it's a little bit taking the piss. And as you say, everyone doing a PhD is a very educated, very qualified person. You know, a lot of us, this is our third degree. You know, all my friends who don't work in science are like, I don't understand how you guys are the most overqualified, underpaid people. And I think that can be really frustrating, because when you finish university as a scientist, you know, having an undergrad is no longer good enough. Having a master's now isn't necessarily good enough. So you're almost forced by the career options that you have to go and do this further education. And a master's, if it's not integrated into your undergrad, that puts you in debt. Then you go on to a PhD, and actually you get to a point where you're in your late 20s and you've never earned a decent amount of money, you know, and how that then affects your life going forwards and the trajectory and what you can do at certain milestones, you know, it really does impact. It's not a kind of short term, hey, I can't afford to go clubbing every Thursday, like I don't, but you know, it's not just that, it's also, I suppose, the long term implications of the financial sacrifice that you make and how that changes your life. And it makes doing a PhD more than just a career decision, it is a whole lifestyle decision. And Jodie, I know you found this. You've managed to plow through and still do these milestones like weddings and buying a flat and everything else. But I, you know, plenty of other people have not. And it's, you're reliant then, I suppose, on having a partner who's happy to support you or, you know, something like that. So I think it's not even just the immediate rises in the cost of living. It's actually what's the long-term impact. And you presume doing a PhD is going to improve your career options and your earning potential going forwards, but does it, and by how much? And, you know, is it worth the sacrifice that you make for 4 years? I don't know. And that's a decision that everyone has to come to. And yeah, as you say, Jodie, some people decide that it's not worth it and they're being priced out. And, you know, actually having a stable job, and instead of spending 4 years on the same salary and not getting promoted, you could go and do a grad scheme in finance and end up on 70k after 4 years, you know. And then you look at it and you're like, well, why not?
Yeah. And I think, you know, having to weigh up all of those things and make those decisions, I don't know about you, but so as like a first gen student and the first in my family to go to university and to navigate all of these steps, the path in front has always been very misty, and only really knowing the steps that I'm supposed to be taking right now as I'm stumbling across them. So it's not having that knowledge, that privilege of knowledge of what you're supposed to be doing and when. And I think that's very much relevant to this conversation, because growing up in a low socioeconomic background, so from a single parent family, I've worked since I was 13, and often my wages were not going on, going to the cinema with my friends or anything like that. They were going to my mum to help pay for my school shoes or to put electric on the meter key or something like that. So I actually come from quite a poor background. And to me, finding out that I was doing okay at school and that I could go to university was like my get out card. It was like education equals good job equals money. And so that's the kind of path that I set myself out on. And it isn't until you're too far down that rabbit hole when you start to realize that maybe going into academia is really not good financially, that it's too late and you're invested and, you are the kind of person that enjoys research. And so you are then stuck in this battle between, I've gone too far, I'm now in a PhD, I can't give up now. I think it's that not having the knowledge of all of your cards in front of you so that you can make the right decision. But it needs to be an informed decision, and absolute stress on the word informed.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I, to an extent, also have a similar experience there, where education was always encouraged and like more education always equals better prospects. And then you get so far down the line, you're like, oh, actually, I don't think that's true. But I also just wanted to pick up on something Sophie said earlier, where you were talking about the idea of guilt around talking about finances and wanting a certain amount of financial security, particularly in academia, and how quite often we're made to feel guilty. Because I mean, let's be real, people aren't asking for a six-figure salary necessarily. The fact is, people just want enough money to be able to live off of and not have to worry about paying the bills. Am I going to be able to eat at the end of the week when like payday's not come yet, and things like that, so that they can do their jobs? And we're made to feel like we're asking for too much, when all we're asking for is kind of enough if we wanted more than that, like that's, we're absolutely well within our rights to want more than like a basic level of financial security. But it really like frustrates me about academia, and it's something I've really thought about a lot, especially this past year, because personally for me, financially, it's been pretty tough the past year. And I've really noticed as well, like how much stress it adds on and the amount of stress you carry around. In a lot of ways, it's hard to put into words what it is, but it's sort of just always there at the back of your head, sort of adding things up and even little things like, oh, someone asks you to go to the pub and you're like, oh, can I actually afford that? And you have to do a quick bit of mental maths, and then like, am I gonna have to make up an excuse or can I actually go? And or things like that. Can I afford to get the tube to work?
This is something we were talking about. It's not even just the optional extras, right? Yeah. It's literally you find yourself thinking, do I need to be in the lab today, or can I use my laptop at home and save myself the £5 that it takes me to get into work and back? It's like you shouldn't really be in this position that we are in. You shouldn't really be thinking, can I afford to get to work to do the job that I need to do? And it's just completely normal. It's been normalized.
Even then, right, you think, okay, I'm going to work from home, but then I have to plug my laptop in to charge it. That's then the electric. We all know how much electric's gone up. Is it actually easier if I just go into work and I do it there? It's that whole, as you say, the balancing, the mental math of, can I afford this coffee? Can I do this? And then, if you have friends outside of academia or outside of PhD and they want to do things and you don't want to be that person who's like, oh no, actually, can we just stay in and cook? Or, and also we're living in London, right? You don't want to sit at home.
Yeah.
We're living in London in our 20s, I'm not saying we should all be going and popping bottles of champagne every Friday night, but to be able to go to the pub and have a pint and it not be a, can I afford this? Should I be doing this? Maybe I should go home instead. It's it's that balance.
I think there's also this really wild disconnect when it comes to people who are perhaps in a more financially privileged position, of which there've been many in the media sort of saying what they think perhaps people should be doing to save a bit more money. And the reality is that, one drink in a week with your friends at the pub, that's really not like a decadent expense. Like there shouldn't be this idea that if you're financially struggling, you have to just sit at home and have a joyless life. There's such a disconnect there.
I agree. I think that we work bloody hard, right? We work bloody hard. And so it's like, I should be able to find enjoyment things. And it doesn't always need to cost money. Right. So, exactly. I mean, I this weekend I did a lot of geocaching. And if you're listening and you don't know what geocaching is, you need to find it out, because you can do it for free. It gets you walking a lot and it's fun. Gets you in the outdoors. So, yeah, I'm not saying that everything you do, even in London, needs to cost money. But it's the thought process of, actually, I deserve this. I work my ass off, so if I want to go to the pub and have a pint or go and have a lunch or whatever that may be, and it's not necessarily something really extravagant, I shouldn't be weighing up, or I shouldn't be at the detriment of my mental health and my well-being and that work-life balance, be thinking, actually, no, I need to just sit home and do this and do that. Because how are we supposed to strive for it all? How are we supposed to look after ourselves? You know, there's the presenteeism and things like that that exists in academia, so we need to be working hard, but also make sure you're looking after yourself, because the university pushes that message. But also don't look after yourself too much, because then that costs too much money. So I just don't understand how to get the balance right, because whatever you do, you're going to be pissing someone off.
You said then mental health, and Rebecca, you said earlier that, you know, finances, it's always in the back of your mind. Like, it is, and it does affect your mental health, and it is a worry, and you don't need that on top of the pressures of doing a PhD, you know. And I think what frustrates me the most in academia is everyone knows it. Everyone knows it's not enough money. Supervisors know it. People high up in the system know it. But no one changes it. And it's almost like, when we did PhDs, we were on similar. So, you know, it's that whole kind of cycle of, we did it, so you have to do it. But actually, it's not proportional. You know, cost of living is not going up at the same proportion as PhD stipends. Like, even now, I think I was looking at the increases for next year. It's not in line with inflation fully. You know, so actually it's not the same. We're not in the same position as the people who are at the top of the system now. And we're actually in a financially worse position, but no one does anything about it. And the kick in the teeth is when they see how much that they've put aside for consumables. And you're like, really? Per month? I'm worth less than an antibody? You know, where's the balance? Because it's not like there's not money in science. You know, there is. But it's never spent on people. And, you know, for me, like I was saying earlier, that financial implication was a big decision in doing a PhD. You know, I was in industry and I did the maths. You know, how much do I earn in industry after tax? How much am I living comfortably on what I'm on now? Am I still managing to save money for my future on what I'm on now? And I worked out what that minimum amount was. You know, living in Cambridge, I thought, hey, London's probably a little bit extra. And I then, you know, applied for PhD programs based on that. And it felt like a really callous way to do it. I felt bad for doing it. But I was like, I know that I'm not good with having that financial pressure and that financial insecurity. And just for me mentally, I needed to know that I would be okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't always afford to be picky about which PhD programs you go for. Sometimes you don't get offered places. You know, I didn't for all of the ones I applied for. So it is really tough, and it shouldn't be a decision that you have to make, and you shouldn't feel guilty for making it. I even feel guilty sometimes within my department, because I know that other PhD students are not on the same amount that I am on. And, you know, I'm aware that they're maybe struggling more than I am, but, you know, I made the decisions that I made. And that, I suppose, also partly is, like you're saying, Jodie, I had that information. You know, I knew that there were better funded projects out there. So I looked for them. But if I hadn't had no idea. You know, you don't. I was told, because I chatted to a lot of different people about doing PhDs, if you don't have that resource to draw upon, then what are you meant to do? You just go for what you think is interesting, or whatever program will take you. You know, it's...
I just knew, because I thought they were all the same. And I thought, I knew that in London, you got, obviously, it adjusted for London living. But I didn't realise there was such a difference between the different programmes. I assumed that they all followed a guidance of, this is how much you pay your PhDs. And so, yeah, on the information that I had, I just took the PhD that I was offered and that I thought I was going to enjoy. And I think for me, because I was on this path for so long, thinking that this is what I need to do to get myself in a better position so that then my children are in a better position than I was, and so on and so on. Because I was had that in my head for so long, even though after my master's, I was earning more money because I was working for like a startup, not in academia. I still found myself wanting to go back to the lab because I felt like I was giving up on something that has been in my head for so long, and that I'd feel guilty, or I'd feel like I'd let myself down or not fulfilled my potential, or however you want to phrase it, if I didn't do the PhD. And so it's like, now I'm halfway through my PhD, you know, I want to complete it because it's not something that I want to quit. And at times I'm really enjoying it. This happy, you've caught me in a good spell, you know, so at times I'm really enjoying it. And I'm glad that I'm doing a PhD. I'm grateful I'm doing a PhD. But at other times I'm like counting down the days until it's finished so that I can earn a proper wage. And I'm thinking, why on earth did I do it? And almost regretting doing the PhD, and I just want to get it done so it's another thing ticked. So it is a real like internal battle, and you feel guilty either way, because I know that I'm in a much better position than you know, other PhD students. Like you said, I got married, I've bought a flat, I'm living in London, but that's because of my partner. If I was living alone, there's no way I'd been able to reach any of those like life milestones, as you put them. And so it's like not just a financial decision or a career decision, but it really is a whole life decision, because it may not just delay by the 4 years that you're sat in your PhD program. It may delay way beyond that, or maybe even change the directions and the opportunities that are there for you when you finish your PhD. And I had no idea. So it's, for me, it's too late.
Save yourselves.
I'm here. I've got to finish this thing. And hopefully things will be all right at the end of it. But it's, you know, it's important that we have these conversations without the feeling of like taboo, because we're talking about money, without the, you know, feeling guilty about certain topics. It needs to be an open discussion, because people who are considering this as a career need to have all of the information.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, like you say, there's a pathway in academia, right? You do your undergrad, you do your master's, you do your PhD. And at each point, you are given the impression that it's going to benefit you for your future, for your career, for your earning potential, all this type of thing. But you always finish one, and then it's like, oh, but you could just do a PhD, or once you finish your PhD, if you just do one postdoc, yeah, you know. And it's then very hard to break out of, like you say. But it does, yeah, reach a point where you're like, when am I gonna earn an actual salary? And friends that I left uni with are on their fifth promotion, and you know, buying houses and doing all these other things, and you're like, God, why am I so far behind? And I think it's this thing, right? Like, we're all, I think, slight, not overachievers. I don't know if that's the right word, but
no,
I think
we are.
There's that mentality. Yeah, I'm trying to be polite, but let's go for it. You know, that there is that mentality of, I suppose, the people who've got to this level, of like, you always need to be doing more and you always need to achieve more and you never feel you're doing enough. There's a lot of intricacies amongst the financial situation of being in academia that just come from the kind of general culture of academia as well.
On that note, talking about the culture in academia, are there any things that you think more generally, apart from obviously the low pay and the insecurity in terms of short contracts, especially after your PhD, in that sort of that the abyss between getting your PhD and becoming a PI, the few people that managed to do it. Apart from that, do you think there's any things more generally in culture in academia that really contributes to this? To give an example, for me, the one thing I really hate is this culture of expecting us to be able to pay up front for expenses, like things for conferences and posters and things. Like, at this point, even forget booking flights for a conference, even just like a spare 20 quid for a poster, I'm just like, you're expecting me to front this and then expense me it later? I hate it. I think it needs to go in the bin. I can see you nodding. So
yeah, no, 100%. And I actually saw a tweet about this the other day, because someone, their costs for a conference, it was like nearly $2,000 or something, and their PI was expecting them to pay it, and they were like, that is more than my stipend for the month. Like, I genuinely couldn't afford that even if I wanted to what are you expecting me to do here?
I think people just think that everyone has savings. Everyone has a magical pot that they can dip into if that month's, you know, wage doesn't stretch, you know, as far as it should. But not every people do live month to month, and not everyone has that reserve fund. And so the assumption that you do, or that you have, even if you have a credit card, the assumption that you could put it on a credit card, and then if it takes too long for them to reimburse you, you might then get charged. It's like, you know, not everyone can do that. And it, that's all deeply rooted in the fact that people who used to go to university were the very elite, the very rich. And and it just all comes back to that, basically. And it's like, we think that we've moved on. And in many ways, you know, obviously there has been improvements and things like that. But in many ways, a lot of the underlying bare bones of academia are still deeply rooted in the fact that it's rich white men that go to university.
And like, as great as it is that we're seeing these changes at an undergraduate level, if it doesn't follow through into postgraduate and for, you know, even higher education, then is it really having an impact?
It's like, who are we selecting for if we're making it this hard? It will be interesting to see if this is going to be any kind of a wake-up call, because it does feel like there's this kind of exodus at the moment of people leaving academia.
My Twitter is filled with it, and I'm like, okay, who's staying?
But then it makes me nervous, because like, my plan has been for quite a while now to leave academia, and now I see that all these people are leaving academia. I think, bollocks, there's gonna be no jobs left outside of academia. I'm gonna have to fucking stay.
But then there aren't the jobs within either, so you're just unemployed. It's a bright picture we're painting, isn't it?
I know, I know. I mean, there are obviously positives, but that's not what today's episode's about.
We're going to really zone in on the negatives here.
Listen to our other episodes if you want to hear some of the good stuff.
There is some.
No, sometimes it's just good to talk about the shit, especially on this kind of stuff, because like you said earlier, Sophie, everyone knows this is a thing in academia and people just don't talk about it.
One more thing to kind of wrap up what we've been talking about today before we kind of sadly say goodbye to you. Often people feel the need during their PhD to supplement that income, that tiny stipend, meaning that they're working more than one person's workload. So if you're a full-time PhD student, for example, that's one person's work, often more, but that's a whole nother discussion. And then on top of that, you may be working part-time. So even though some PhD programs advise against it or have certain strict rules with how many hours you're supposed to do every week or every month, it is something that a lot of PhD students do. So yeah, I just wanted to talk a little bit about your experiences of juggling other paid work, whether that be a regular part-time work or other paid like initiatives alongside the PhD. And if you feel like having to do this affects your PhD performance in any way or makes it more challenging, or whether it's just the mental workload, if we could just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so obviously, I'm only like a year and a half into my PhD now, but in that time, I have done lab demonstrating, I've done marking undergrad papers, and I've recently been hired to do some freelance writing as well. So I have done a variety of different things to try and supplement PhD income. It's also, I can have those treats that we were talking about earlier, which aren't necessarily even treats, but that I can go to the pub on a Friday night and not worry about how much a pint costs, you know, because I know that I've done a certain number of hours demonstrating that week. So it balances out. In terms of how it affects my PhD, it depends on what I've been doing. So marking is something you can do in front of the TV in the evening. It extends your work day, I suppose, but it doesn't take up chunks of your 9 to 5. The demonstrating I found really took up chunks of 9 to 5, and that then affected how much work I was getting done that week with the PhD. And I often then did stuff on the weekend because I felt like I needed to catch up. And I have tried throughout my PhD to have quite a strict 9 to 5 Monday to Friday rule. Like, I really try and enforce that because, you know, that's what I did in industry. I know it's possible to still get a good amount of work done in that time, and I don't want to be that person where the PhD is my whole life. So that was frustrating to me then, having to work on the weekends, because the weekends are my downtime.
Mm-hmm. So the $1 million question, Sophie, to wrap up on, do you think you're going to stay in academia?
If my supervisor's listening, yes.
Don't worry about them.
Generally speaking, no.
You don't need to justify it, you know. Just
no, I think to be honest, I'm even questioning if I want to stay in research. So I love science, and I love, you know, discussing science and being a part of it. But in terms of the actual lab work, you know, a lot of the cons that we've spoken about today are things that factor into my decision. So but obviously I have another 2.5 years left
to figure
that out. Yeah, PhD program. So God knows, you could re-interview me again in another 2 years and I'd be like, I love academia and I'm staying forever. Yeah. But no, I think, yeah, the career path just doesn't appeal, you know? Yeah, short contracts, long hours, poor pay, a lot of sacrifice, both personally and from the work perspective. And I look at the kind of end result and go, do I really want that? And is it worth it? And the answer tends to be probably not. So
fair enough.
To be blunt.
No, honestly, I think without going into massive amounts of detail, because we're a bit short on time, I think honestly the same, like looking at the end of my PhD, and it's super frustrating because I'm like, I would love to be a PI and I think I'd be really great at it, but mm-hmm. I'm just like, do I have the mental energy and capacity to just, you know, constantly slog at fellowships that I've got like 1% chance of getting, and I'm just like, is it worth it? And it's just, yeah, it's really, it's difficult. But yeah, we'll see. Who knows, maybe this time next year I'll be doing that instead.
Well, good luck.
Yeah, we'll see. So yeah, usually what we like to do is ask our guests if there's anything that you'd like to share with our audience, and this can literally be anything, whether it's a project or initiative you're involved with, or any campaigns, charities you'd like to share.
I would encourage people to get involved in public engagement initiatives. I think people are anyway, just because it's becoming part of funding packages, but it is also quite rewarding, especially the patient focus side. I've got a lot from that. So I would recommend getting involved in that if you see opportunities coming up through. It's really good.
And so, yeah, just generally, is there anything else you wanted to say to end on that you either felt you didn't get a chance to say earlier, or you just really wanted to sum up with?
I suppose try and get, if you're thinking of doing a PhD, try and get as much information as possible before deciding to do it. You know, talk to as many people as possible who've done different types of PhDs, and make sure that you're making the best decision for you, because it's not a small decision to make, and it is a big commitment, both in terms of time, you know, life sacrifices and financial sacrifices. So just for your own well-being, make sure you go into it with your eyes open and that you're fully informed. And I think it's a common trait of PhD students that we don't like to give up and drop out, so
we think we'll be the exception.
Yeah, you know, and you do tend to, once you're in it, you feel like you can't get out of it and you've got to see it through. So make sure you're seeing it through for the right reasons.
Yeah,
good advice.
And lastly, where can our audience follow you? So do you have a social media or a professional website or a blog?
I have Twitter.
Okay.
I don't know what my username is, though. Let me just check that.
I love that.
Okay, it's really original. It's @Sophie_Langdon6. There we
okay,
go.
Great.
I should really know that off by heart, shouldn't I?
I mean, it wasn't very complicated, though. I was expecting like a string of digits.
Yeah.
No, absolutely not. It's not even a cool science-themed one.
We'll put that in our show notes for this episode so that people can go and follow you.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for coming and talking to us and letting us talk your ear off on a Monday evening. It's been an absolute delight, and I think we've covered a lot of really interesting stuff. So thank you very much.
No, it's been a pleasure. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me to come talk, even if it did turn into a little bit of a rant at points.
I feel like it was needed, though. We let it out this episode.
Therapeutic on a Monday.
Yeah, it means that the rest of the week is going to go swimmingly.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I hope so.
listening to that interview, if you got as riled up and agitated and frustrated as we did and are wondering what you can do to try and make a difference, so I want to take this moment to plug a Google form that takes literally seconds to fill out. It's the Postgraduate Researchers Against Low Pay, which is an open letter to the UKRI. And basically, they're asking for signatures from all postgraduate researchers and PhD students, regardless of their funding source. So even if you're self-funded PhD students or from non-UKRI sources, they want to hear from you. And it is literally a few seconds. Ask who provides your funding, where you're doing your research, and put your email just to sign this open letter that's going to be sent out. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And if you could spare a few seconds of your time to do that, then that'd be great.
And just to check, just for any international listeners, is this just for UK researchers?
It says, we welcome signatures from all postgraduate researchers and PhD students, regardless of funding source, and from other supporters. So it can even be if you're not a PhD researcher and actually your other university staff, or you're another type of student or another type of supporter, it lets you click it. But then for the university, there's like a drop down of universities, and actually you can select other or none. So you don't have to select that you're going to a UK university. So I think it's open to everyone.
So if you are against postgraduate researchers being underpaid and want to show your support in a way that can have meaningful effect, add your name to the letter.
Yes, please.
And like Jodie said, it takes literally seconds. So if you can, go do it. And so if you want to hear more from the fabulous Sophie Langdon, as she said, you can find her on Twitter. She is at Sophie_Langdon6. So if you want to hear more about her work and things that she posts, go and check her out there. She also mentioned I'm a Scientist, Get Me Out of Here, which is a really fantastic public engagement initiative that scientists can get involved in. So we will leave a link to that in the show notes. I don't know if they're currently in a recruiting round, but we'll put the information on how to find them in the show notes anyway, so that you can keep track of when applications are being accepted and how you can get involved, just so you know where to find information if that's something that you're at all interested in.
As usual, you can find us on social media. We are at The Academinist on both Twitter and Instagram. Do check out our Instagram stories. We've got a couple of interactive polls on there, so you can share your experience of working as a PhD student or in academia. You can share your experiences of financial stress, or just, you know, tell us how you're doing. And it might make other people feel like actually there's community out there and there's other people that are experiencing the same things as them. And if you have more than you can fit into a tweet to say to us, you can always email us at theacademinist@gmail.com.
Yeah, and as usual, if you have really enjoyed listening to this episode and think that we sound like two people you'd love to come and chat to about an issue relating to equality in STEM that you care about, we have a Google form for that. If you go to our social media, you will find in our social media bios the link to the form. It takes literally a couple of minutes to just tell us who you are, your availability, and some of the issues that you want to talk about. And Sophie did just that. So it's really that easy. You could be podcast material. Come and chat to us.
Making dreams happen at just a click of a Google form.
We promise we'll be on our best behavior. We're very friendly, and we like to make sure everyone has a nice time coming on the show. So
we just need to say goodbye.
Yeah, I mean, I assume you've like melted into your duvet by now.
A little bit, yeah. I just need some food.
Basically gone, guys.
I've checked out mentally. Now I just need to do it physically.
Well, on that note,
see you next month. Bye. Bye. You're blurred, it's fine.
we can.
It's chaos. This episode's chaos.
He's wearing my dressing gown.
So. I was gonna say, what is that blue?